have music with you, Andrew, and are you? Are you?
Sure.
It's all set up and everything?
Well, I mean.
Kinda. Yeah.
It's always set up. You want something?
Not right now, I would say, but think about how we might bring the things to a conclusion at lunchtime. Okay? Or maybe or probably a start after lunch, depending on, or a start to start in the second section. We'll see how it goes. So this morning in two hunks I want to review the core teaching, and you might also almost call it the shorthand on the worlds. And because it forms the basic vocabulary, the basic conceptual map that we're going to operate on. It was Lynn Bauman who introduced me many, many years ago to the term heuristic. And a heuristic is a short little formula or quick fix that in itself may be simplistic, but it's very, very useful because it sort of gives you the heart of it. It's like a kind of Cliff Notes version of it that at least allows you to see something and start working with it. So the maps of the world are, essentially a heuristic, but they're so deeply wrought and writ in the human soul that they take us almost back. In virtually every tradition we have, that comes out of what's called the great Sophia Perennis, or perennial wisdom, both East or West, we have this model that just sort of comes to the fore of essentially the great chain of being as a sort of quick cosmogonic heuristic. Now there's a vocabulary test. In other words, a quick short picture of the creation, and expansion of the universe.
Can you spell heuristic?
Heuristic? HEURISTIC.
Okay.
Things that we need to look for and see if we can scrounge between now and later would be a flip. I think I've got a flip chart in the house, but maybe not a board to put it on, or we'll look and see what's available.
I've got this.
Yeah.
Do you want this?
What?
The chart.
Oh, yeah.
And this, and then this is great.
Oh, great. Well, yeah. When you put them up there, you've blown up Andrew's maps.
Yeah.
You'll find a lot of this stuff in the book when you buy it, and we'll call attention to all that. But the whole idea that just sort of haunts the human imagination in all worlds is that whatever you want to call God, primordial source, cause of all things, primordial consciousness, at some point sort of explodes itself out into this great redshift explosion, and out of this original sort of fiery big bang impulse of the divine will to form emerge worlds. And in the classic map, each world gets denser, colder, more mechanical, more removed from center. And that kind of a map shows up in so many ways and so many vestiges in everything from Vedanta, Advaita Vedanta, roadmaps of levels of consciousness, to Plato and his whole idea of the intelligible universe. I mean, it's a very, very deep concept. The Sufis, the whole 12th century Islamic, what they call Islamic Platonism, developed the whole idea of these maps of the worlds, the great chain of being, to very high and intricate ways. But it's a kind of archetypal map that at least, consciousness north of the equator has tended to gravitate to, both east and west, to sort of help visualize the emergence of somethingness or form out of nothingness. And So we're going to be working on this. Gurdjieff basically gave us two variations on the same theme. You know, he has two maps that are basically maps of the world. One done from an inner perspective that basically corresponds more to maps that the East would call levels of consciousness. The other corresponding more directly to what Western world would call the worlds, you know, the different realms of being. So I want to look at both of them because they become interesting ways of trying to imagine what is essentially unimaginable. And the reason it's unimaginable is because it overrides the wiring of the human conceptual mind to hold it. You know, it's basically bigger than our two-dimensional rational mind can contain, so we just can't fathom it. It's like the old Flatlands sci-fi story of trying to imagine three dimensions when you're only set up to function in two. You know, so the maps are always, we construe them as imaginary because we have not yet ramped up the powers of imagination within us that would actually be able to envision these. But a very, very interesting and I think important newcomer to the classic theme of the maps of the world was contributed by Valentine Tomberg in his classic Meditations on the Tarot. And I refer to this at some point. I wish I'd sort of highlighted it, but you can find it somewhere in there. He's talking in one section of the book where he's talking about energy and consciousness, and he says, essentially, we know now that matter is simply highly condensed energy. Okay? You know, highly coagulated, slower moving. And he says, just as science has now discovered that, which was, of course, Einstein's big discovery in 1905 that set the world on a whole different footing, he says, so we'll also discover that energy is simply a condensation of what he calls psychic energy. And that psychic energy, in turn, is simply a condensation of what we call pure consciousness. So he's given us a fourfold map there based on energy, which is really, really useful. Rather than, you know, let's start with these imaginary ontological worlds, you know, the imaginal, the causal, the, you know, the supersensible, you know. Because we all know, post-Einstein now, the continuum of energy. And we all know, even though many of us still struggle to believe it, that bench you're sitting on is only energy temporarily in more dense form. And if we set Andrew loose with his cigarette lighter, sooner or later it would be returned to flame. So we know that. We've gotten familiar now with the cusp between matter and physical energy. So what Tomberg did in this map is add on two more categories that we don't know that much about. What in the hell is psychic energy? When he says that physical energy is just a kind of slowing down or condensation of psychic energy. Well, we actually know exactly what that is. That every single one of us in this room and every single human being has some experience of psychic energy. These are the things that create outcome and result in the world, but are so subtle that science has not yet deigned to measure them. Things like love, let's start with that one. We know that love has an effect in the physical world, right? Things that are loved tend to grow. Things that are not loved tend to shrivel. So it has an expanding and a nurturing and a healing effect. Will. You know, when somebody sets their will on something, it creates a different outcome. but nobody measures it. Attention, a huge psychic energy. And this is the one that Gurdjieff got right onto. When you do something with attention, it has a whole different quality to it, doesn't it? Than when it's just done with lackadaisical, you know, we're on autopilot. Prayer. You know, when prayer is done efficaciously, it's not just a, oh, I'm lifting up Rabbi. It's a direct placement of a quality of concern meeting a stream that meets us from the other side. It's an extremely, you know, powerful channel of connections. So these kinds of things that we all have some sort of familiarity with in life, they say, oh, they're energies, I never thought of them as energies. Like, I once challenged a friend of mine who was chair of the Department of Physics at the University of British Columbia. I said, well, why don't you scientists measure attention? Why don't you call it an energy? It fits the definition of energy. You know, it has a different effect when you actually put it in. It does work, you know, and consumes itself doing work. So why don't you measure it? Well, he got a graduate student going on it and trying to see whether they could develop formula. But I'm myself about 99% convinced that what Ballantyne Tolberg means when he talks about, when he uses the term psychic energy and physical energy, is exactly what Teilhard de Chardin means when he uses the terms radial energy and tangential energy. And he's very, very clear that tangential energy is, it's exactly what Tolberg calls physical energy. You know, it's the mechanical energy that's transferred, you know, that's in latent in matter when work is done. But radial energy seems to to correlate very brilliantly in Teilhard with what, would you agree with that, Bree?
Yeah.
With what Tolberg's calling psychic energy. And the very, for him, the interesting thing for Teilhard when he used the term radial energy, he was talking about more subtle energies. And that for Teilhard, they were at least implicitly counter-entropic. And evolution belonged in the sphere of one such thing. It was a force and a stream of purpose and intentionality that rather than just falling under the second law of thermodynamics had a different property that drove evolution to yet finer and more intense forms of organization. So Teilhard was already beginning to work in this bandwidth as a scientist of trying to get a grip on what radio or psychic energy is. And then Tolberg had this following wing, and soon we'll find out that even psychic energy or radial energy is simply a condensation or a slowing down of what he calls pure consciousness. And of course, well, what is pure consciousness? It depends on what religion, what psychic stream you're working on, but clearly what Tolberg is intending by this, and what most of the Eastern metaphysical use of this term would bring, is that all-encompassing, undifferentiated, ultra, so intense and pure fullness of divine knowingness or purpose, that it not only contains the all, but is the creative mainstream of everything. You might use the words omniscience, fullness, the Godhead. We'll get back to that in a minute. But the highest thing, the source from which all else spills, is consciousness in these maps. So you have this, again, even Talmberg's model follows that classic red shift model. The most fine, the most intense, the most powerful, the generative is consciousness. From there, it shoots out, loses a little energy, takes on a little bit more form, and becomes psychic energy. Teilhard calls it radio energy. Long bandwidth that travels, and then all of a sudden, boom, you get to this interface of tangential, of psychic energy, and physical energy or tangential energy, and boom, then we have matter. And I think that's a very, very good way to transpose these ancient maps that were based on something which is called philosophically substance theology or substance ontology, which is based on a fundamental difference between matter and spirit, which is how the old maps used to be set up. You know, they're worlds that are material and they're worlds that are not material. The energetic maps allow us to see that it's all a single continuous stream emerging from some inscrutable, we call it divine initiative, spilling out into more and more particular and dense and slower moving and boundary form. So it's the classic map, it's archetypal in the human soul, and we're going to be dealing with that map yet again when we begin to imagine the imaginal. Because without such a map, it's impossible to imagine the imaginal. But because it's so profoundly imprinted in the human consciousness, there's reason to believe that it's got a little bit of trustworthiness. So Gurdjieff gives us two renditions of this. As I say, the ray of creation, which I'm going to deal with second in this one. I did the ray of creation first in Valley Crucis, but I'm going to start with the other one, the map of the worlds, because it's more intimate. It depends, it refers a lot more to just levels of consciousness. And it's also something we pick up. People pick up the shorthand instantly and can start using it because it's so recognizable in the world. I did an interview for Goop 2 days ago, and by 5 minutes into the interview, Elise, the interviewer, had the lingo perfectly and was applying it. You know, it's just, it's like, hey, this actually communicates. So, the map of the worlds was Gurdjieff's rendition of it, and he gave each world numbers. And the numbers after the initial cut double. So you have world 1, world 3, world 6, world 12, world 24, world 48, world 96, world 192, and you know, if you want to, you can keep going, but by world 192, we're basically at the end of anything that you would even remotely call sentient. So we're going to stop that. So the numbers in general mean that for Gurdjieff, they describe the density of each of these realms. But density doesn't mean sort of physical materiality so much as the number of laws under which a realm manifests. And generally speaking, the more laws that are on a thing, the more kind of conditions that it has to respond to in order to appear, the denser it's going to be. For Gurdjieff, as for almost all teachers, you know, a realm is not a place. It's not a physical place. You can't take an airplane to the imaginal realm. You know, it doesn't exist in space-time coordinates exactly. But a realm is essentially a set of conditions that allow something to manifest. And the simplest way of depicting what that is, you know, if somebody gives you back when you were doing geometry in seventh grade and gave you a compass, you know, a swing compass. And the rule is you stick the pointy end in the middle of anywhere you want on the page, set the little dial to whatever angle you want, and swing a circle. So those are the rules. The conventions are you put the pointy end in what will be the middle, you set the circle to whatever diameter you want, and you swing it. And what you get out of that, what emerges is the realm. The circle, right? The circle you draw on the page. Okay, you get the picture? So by following these conventions, something manifests on the page. And the more conventions there are, the denser the realm. So as Gurdjieff described them, I started playing with them. I discussed this essentially on, let's see, what page on the book? It's so exciting to me that I've been having a bubble for ever since I had my detached retina surgery, and this morning the bubble disappeared.
Oh my gosh.
And I can see again.
Oh my gosh.
Sort of. Well enough to have been stupid and leave my glasses home. But, and we all have a taste of these realms. The way my map of this differs from Gurdjieff and a lot others is I really radically place what I would call World 12 in a whole different place than most other people do. But you'll see that I'm a mystical Christian, and that's what informs it. But World 1 would correspond to, you know, what Tom Berg would call consciousness, pure consciousness, whatever. That some would call it inaccessible light, the Godhead. People imagine a divine beyond divisibility, beyond knowing, beyond giving a damn about moving into form. Completely in stasis. I describe this. World One is the holy absolute, the Godhead, the inaccessible light, the holy, impenetrable, ineffable, unknowable monad, before God took perceptivity and divisibility, as Jacob Burba describes it. You know, it's God in complete stasis. And what's interesting, and I describe this here, I'll just read it. Of course, this is one of those giant forks in the road where the mystical traditions of the Christian East and Christian West split theologically. For the Western theological mind, with a few notable exceptions, there is no Godhead beyond God. The Trinity is the full, complete, irreducible expression of the whole of divinity. The mystics of both branches, of course, know better and have always smiled serenely at this. So that when the Western theologians got the hold of the Trinity, they jumped on it and said, this is the whole of God, you can go no farther, this is it. And the Easterners were saying, no, behind the visible God is essentially an invisible, inaccessible, unknowable, the Godhead. And it was one of the fundamental ruptures between Eastern and Western Church. But very interestingly, some of the kind of way out there Western mystics like Meister Eckhart were right onto it. And if any of you have been plowing in through the secret embrace Thomas Keating's last book of poems, Thomas was right there too. You know, he's the one that we actually had people reading over the weekend. He talks about the secret embrace between the eternal unmanifest and the creative God can never be revealed. So Thomas, you know, has taken people so far into, you know, the Godhead behind God. And he's done it from personal experience and seeing that, you know, as soon as people figure out what he's actually saying, he's going to be shot down, the Pope is going to outlaw him, and, you know, it'll go the usual way. But he has definitely reclaimed that intuitive knowing that World One exists in some form, And that any theology that tries to not take it seriously has cut itself off from the ground. So it's a very interesting thing. And incidentally, this dialogues in a fascinating way with some of the understandings that are now out there in terms of cosmology, that are saying, hey guys, there wasn't just one big bang. That I said at Valley Crucis that big bangs are like snowflakes in a blizzard, and that the external that the kind of permanent state of whatever you call this whatever is what some of the science call eternal inflation. And then for some reason or another which defies my scientific brain, by once again some monstrous workings of probability, some places, some regions in this eternal expansion get a little bit more dense and randomly collected, and all of a sudden, boom, you have a big bang, and something falls into conditions of createdness where it lasts until it's run out of the energy implicit within the whole system, and boom, then it implodes. But hey, guess what? There's another big bang somewhere else. Cosmoses within cosmoses within cosmoses, blizzards, snowflakes in a blizzard. But this junction between utter impenetrable formlessness and the capacity to allow things to begin to form is a threshold mystery that the most amazing mystics of all eras have stood on, and nobody else wants to know about. That's world one. World three then becomes the primordial trinity, and that it was Beatrice Bruto, not to mention Jacob Burma in our Western tradition, who were the first ones to get on to the fact that if there is to be manifestation at all, it comes from a certain set of conditions, a certain algorithm. And threeness is essential to manifestation. Gurdjieff was also onto it, and he called the law of three the law of world creation. And that Jacob Burma was talking about this, about the eternal unmanifest had to bring himself, if you'll forgive the pronoun, into divisibility and perceptivity. In other words, something had to change within this eternal inflation to allow there to be the conditions that would allow the journey into form to get started in the first place. So three is basically the algorithm of manifestation. Can I say it that way? And what the Christian West, and to an extent the Christian East, is picking up so brilliantly in placing all its eggs in the basket of the Trinity, is that threeness is the nature of the divine reality that allows all further reality to happen. Okay? If you're in the Gurdjieff work, you know all about this, the law of three. But it becomes really, really moving when you understand that there's a vein of Christian mysticism that isn't just talking about Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, or, you know, Mother God, you know, Daughter and Holy Trinity and Holy Spirit understood as feminine. You know, it's not about three people. The three people, or the three persons as they're called, is essentially a kind of snapshot borrowed from World 6 to allow us to envision and to essentially personify a principle, a foundational proto-principle of manifestation. and to begin to approach it from a personal sense, which is the only way we can ever approach anything spiritually. You know, as human beings, as we are, for very good reasons, when we kick the personal out of it, we kick the love out of it, and then we can't understand anything. So to make it Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, it borrows from how this principle might be envisioned in World 6, but it allows us to begin to stretch our own hearts into it. So I forgive the Trinity completely, and I don't go for Creator, Redeemer, and Sanctifier, and which everybody loves because it's gender neutral. It's also relationship neutral. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit is so deeply relational, and it begins to set the ground that manifestation is within a field. You know, what are the conditions of perceptivity and divisibility is relationality, and it goes way, way, way back. So that would be World 3. World 6 corresponds to I said the inaugural leap into outward manifestation, the first declension in Valentine Tomberg's spectrum of energy, where consciousness condenses into psychic force. World 6 is for me the headwaters where this first thing happens, where you begin to be dealing with that transition between pure consciousness, as it were, and some energy that starts to move at an extremely subtle level. I talk about this, if any of you remember, by Holy Trinity and the Law of Free Book, mm-hmm. I talk about this as the third Trinity. But it's up for the Eastern religions, this would be the causal realm. For Plato, I think it's the intelligible universe. For J.G. Bennett, I think this is what he's pointing to when he talks about the demiurgic universe. We're beginning to deal with the headwaters of substantiality. Not yet form in a heavy, dense, material way, but the finest kind of energy that can actually be touched by the human being directly. I think J.G. Bennett, that student of Gurdjieff, was right on when he tended to place the sexual energy as deriving from that, ideally, as the most subtle energy that human beings could actually touch while still in the flesh. The primordial creativity. So that's World 6. It tends to be apersonal, I would call, on the way up, because it has not yet been personalized. It's wildly, brilliantly, intelligently, compulsively creative. But a little fierce, a little Himalayan in some of its manifestations. So then we get to World 12. And World 12 is a world that will concern us very, very deeply as we do our work this week. As a matter of fact, much of where we're going to go, particularly toward the end of this week, if we're really lucky, will take place in World 12. I call World 12 the Christic realm. And this is really different for most people. Most people in the maps will, you know, when they do the Ken Wilber maps of consciousness, they put Jesus up there. Oh, he's the non-dual realms. But I don't believe so. I believe the Christic came into being because as Moses learned, you know, nobody can see the face of God and live. You know, as Isaiah and some of them learned, you know, hide your face because, you know, and even Ladislaus Boros talks about, you know, Christ has come to earth, says Laudis Los Boros in The Mystery of Death, to in some sense diffuse and shelter the danger in meeting God face to face. That Jesus begins to define that realm in which love in the highest kind of form flows safely and profoundly as a bridge between the realms. A love that overwhelms us in a way. I mean, when work 12 hits you, you know it. But you can take it. Because it's gentle. That's when your hearts are moved to tears in a very deep way. When you know that the hand of the master has been on you. When there's an intimacy. It's what you occasionally feel in an exchange, like when Brother Roger died at Taizé, now 15 years ago, when his throat was slit in the middle of the service by a borderline who had an issue about being not properly acknowledged. And the monks were there to try and grab her, and he simply looks at her and radiates this complete generative forgiveness and blessing. What does a soul do in the presence of that? And yet we know that. We know that when the divine love becomes so gentle that the sun can actually touch a snowflake without killing it, we know World 12 in our world. And I believe really strongly, you know, Teilhard lived in World 12. And I believe that his omega point, you know, where he talked about it just resting outside this world, just beyond it, I think he's actually talking about it rests outside World 12. And what really gets consummated in this particular sphere is the complete personalization of all that's originally thrown out as wanton creativity. And the realms, particularly 12, 24, and 48, and to some extent 96, are supremely the realm of the personal in evolution. And when all has been actualized in that realm, the heart of God, which is Christ, has been fully revealed and consummated at Omega. And so, whatever we're doing this week and in all the remaining weeks of our lives must take its reference point in World 12, because it's supremely the home of love, agape love, love made full, love made whole, love made personal, love ultimately embodied in a human being who works the planet. Walks the planet. And notice when I say ultimately, I don't mean exclusively. Ultimately always means in spiritual vocabulary, fully and completely. Inclusively rather than exclusively. So by saying that Jesus the Christ ultimately incarnates this love, I'm not saying that Buddha doesn't. Okay? I'm not saying that Brother Roger doesn't. I say that all who reach and touch this, even in an instant in their life, incarnate fully that energy, because we touch it as a whole, wholly and seamlessly in ourselves. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm. So beautifully taught. That's beautiful.
Yeah. So we participate in it holographically, yeah. but in a profound way, Christ ultra incarnates and holds up for us and defines the sphere in which this kind of fully grown love, which I think is the heart of God and the real purpose of this whole journey into form on our Big Bang, where it struggles, dies, is reborn, falls on its face, is forgiven, and gradually we're evolving. It's the realm in which the best and finest that we can do as human beings is handed up into the higher realms as the whole thing goes along. So terrifically important. And for me, the big reason why so much of secular evolutionary theory falls short, even very good maps like Kid Wilbur's and, you know, all those other people, Craig Hamilton, all these secular evolutionists, Andrew Kellen, you know, non-dual man, is it lacks World 12. World 12 is only approached through devotion, through adoration, through the bending of the knee of the heart. But what cascades through it is paschal courage. It's the home of that. It's the home of the really solar foods that feed the deepest part of our own highest growing self and love. And when we cut off our relationship with that realm, you know, it's, you know, there's not an awful lot of point. We can certainly evolve into the non-dual, but we won't necessarily become pleasant people in the process of it. You know, it's the font of all givingness. I think it's the reason why everybody loves Babette's Feast, because it touches World 12 and drags you right into it. The peace that surpasses all understanding, the gift, the abundance that surpasses all fear. That's for us in World 12. It's the mystical body of Christ, operative and fully alive in this realm. So we have to pay attention to World 12. It's not nothing. It's the realm too that the great martyrs have drawn on. When you find someone like William Robinson, the Quaker, one of the three Quakers who got hanged in Boston Common for the unpardonable sin of practicing Quakerism in Puritan Boston. And as he goes to his grave, he says, and then Paulette sets to music, "The streams of my father's love run daily through me. The streams of my father's love run daily through me. From the holy fountain of life to the sea throughout the whole creation." You know, so in the moment of his death, he's feeling not, "Oh my God, they're going to kill me, the bastards." He's just feeling his oneness with the whole of the creative universe redeemed with love, as everybody feels in that paschal moment. Anyway, which brings us to World 24, twice as heavy. World 24 is classically the imaginal realm. So this is what we're talking about. In the classic maps that were based on substance ontology, I mean the completely illusory distinction between form and matter, between matter and spirit, it was the last of the spiritual realms, you know. And that kind of map was bankrupted by Einstein. But it really sits at the cusp between the psychic energy, you know, it's the last of the realms in which psychic energy is the coin of the realm. You know, the subtly moving embodiedness. In that realm, things like the gifts of the spirit, joy, gentleness, peace, forbearance, are not just qualities, they're energies. Mm. They're energetic streams. They're actually, in some ways, substances. It's the realm of the innermost essences of things. It's the realm of that deeper presence. It's the home of your second body, just as World 12 is the home of your third body. And it's the It's the realm that we're going to be talking with that lives in a particularly intimate and interconnected reciprocal relationship with this realm that's gone missing, but that really serves as a critical intertidal zone in the whole transmission of energies between the realm. And I'll tell you more about that this afternoon, or after we have our coffee break shortly. But so when we talk about imaginal realm, we'll talk about World 24, and I'll hedge that in a little bit, but that's where that is, the world right above us that we're dealing with here. World 48 is our world as we know it. It's the world of culture. It's the great world of Western civilization. It's the great world of the religions, of thought. It's the great universities. It's the New York Times on its better days, the thoughtful journalism, the world of culture, the world of art, the world of jurisprudence, the world of science. The best of what human culture over the ages has put together to represent to ourselves what it means to be a human being. And it's a good world. It's the world we study and pass on at the university. It's the world in which political discourse and motivation and heroic action as we normally undertake it happens. It's the world in which doctors of divinity are educated and sent to their posts at places like Holy Trinity Wall Street and Riverside Church you get it, culture, thoughtful. I think, therefore I am. The great philosophical traditions. It's all that that civilization has meant to us. And it's good stuff. You're going to see when we get back after our coffee break that it is on the other side of what I will present to you as the me-fa divide. It's still in the lower octave. It lacks in and of itself a certain transformational capacity, and we're going to see what the implications of that is, but it's a good place. And it's the world which, in some sense, liberal politics at its best tries to pitch to. I would say, hoping that I'm not revealing my naivete here, it's the world of the Enlightenment in which the founding principles of our Constitution were thoughtfully construed based on the model of human civility and discourse, courtesy, ability to negotiate differences of opinion and still maintain cordiality and learning. So it really is the natural home of democracy. Okay? But the slippery slope continues. World 96 is what you would call the formatory world. It's the world where there is no such thing as thinking really takes place. What you have is slogans and recycled information. You have cliches passed on. You have thought bites rather than thought. You have polarization, because people can't hook thought bites up because they're intense, intentionally polarized. It's the world of turf wars. It's the kind of primitive wars of thinking used to identify belonging rather than to widen belonging. This is our group. This is what we think. Rather than thinking as a way of building bridges. So it's the world of Madison Avenue. It's the avenue, it's the world of slogans. Be all you can be, wear a t-shirt with a brand name on your chest. It's you get it. And that I would say that those of us who are older in the room, which is most of us, have watched in the time of our life the level of consciousness in our culture slip dramatically from World 48 to World 96. You know, and we've just seen that, you know, and TV had a lot to do with it, the discovery of advertisement. But we're, you know, the not only the inability of children nowadays, but the militant unwillingness to read what my grandson calls chapter books that don't have pictures, let alone video interactive components. Boring, you know. The need for continuous distraction, the need to have the radio blaring on in the background at every moment, that's the world we've created. And that world really doesn't sustain democracy because it's slipped below the level at which the fundamental promise of democracy really holds any currency anymore. When people are just exchanging slogans like rapier blows, what chance do you have to sit down without creating, you know, turf wars? So we've seen, I think, pretty clearly a devolution of the note that our country can hold, which is partly what's explaining what's going on right now. But it goes still further on the map of insentiency. And of course, another thing that Russ Hudson pointed out to me one day when we magically kind of devised this map together, teaching an Enneagram class. World 96 is the place where people come into Enneagram studies. Oh, I'm a six. These are my characteristics. The others who are six, that's my group, you know. I do this, I do this, I do this. So at the World 96 level, the Enneagram, you take the test and you hang on to the results as an identifier of who you are. When you move to the World 48 level of it, you begin to discover, oh, you know, my type is not who I am, it's who I am not. It's the set of mechanical, cliched, automatic pilot responses that actually act out in place of me. And so the whole thing shifts when you move to that level. And at that point, you become less interested in fixatedly hanging on to who you are as a type and more interested at that point at how does the cycle spin and grow and how do all the types live in you and how do you grow beyond your particular deformations, which just yesterday you saw as your badge of identity. So,
Cynthia, can you say something about formatory?
Formatory means autopilot. It means you just take the cliched outer surface of things and without further reflection or deeper attention, when things are formatory, the other thing that Gurdjieff would say is that they are not falling on three centers. At least one center and usually two are completely inert. So you're just sort of chugging it around in your mind without your attention gone. Your atmosphere is all over everywhere. You're not in touch with sensation. I would say that without exception, formatory thinking is not in touch with the moving center or formation, or else is only in touch with it and can't connect with actual thinking. So it represents a degradation of the capacities of the human, the particular human brain meaning brain, heart, psyche, temperament.
The way you're describing it, would it also be the equivalent of kind of the Girardian mimetic behavioral patterns?
Yeah.
You kind of take participation out of it, which is why like the political religious has just kind of slipped into this. This is the pre-existing, we must just copy and paste as opposed to participating in.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I would say, too, that, you know, unfortunately, a lot of the thinking that comes out and passes for psychology today is it 96 level? Yeah. You know, even with veritable and esteemed institutions like AA, and some of the stuff that's growing up around victim psychology, so much of that immediately congeals into World 96 constructions of it, so that human beings are seen to be mechanical, and every time this happens, this is going to happen. You know, that what you read in World 96 is mechanization of everything and the growing insentiency of it. And you can see that when we go out of the doors of the room, you deal with vast, vast seas of World 96. That's the Gospel of Thomas, we call it. It's the lion devouring the man.
Yeah.
But World 192, which is the last we'll talk about today, is the world of madness, basically. It's the world where things become so dense, so impacted, so crazy, so nonsensical, so, you know, so intensely overwrought that you can't get back. And we know this both personally and horrifyingly collectively. You know, that we certainly know what happens inside individual beings. All of you who are therapists or whoever walked the journey, when even your normal neurotic functioning breaks and you're suddenly into psychosis. Suddenly things are just crazy. And it's hell. It's intensely heavy inside, you know. It's just intense and pounding and hammering and anguishing, you know. Nobody in World 192 has fun. It really is, you know, what the old maps meant by hell is World 192, where you're being eaten alive from inside. And in the same sort of way, there is a collective descent into World 192. And that's what Lucerin was picking up when he heard the Nazi speeches. And he talks about it, he caught it first in the voice tone and the clip and the kind of energy that was coming through the crowd. But, you know, we're seeing that now, and part of my real sort of sense of needing to hold this country and this country as a part of the world in such intense prayer in the next, you know, 2 months, you know, bracketing either side of the election, basically, 4 months, is because we've already seen signs of collective madness, collective psychosis, and it's going from bad to worse rapidly. When a whole society starts to lose the way to get itself back to even World 96, you're in trouble. And Gurdjieff spoke about this peculiar and horrifying feature of the human psyche that required them to engage periodically in mutual destruction. In other words, wars. You know, but bloodbaths arise for no particular reason. You think you're civilized, and then all of a sudden you've got the Civil War and soldiers are shooting at each other, and, you know, it turns out to die when you haven't been tending the fires. And I would not want to say that we're safe from that reenacting again by any means. So those are the basic shorthand. And you can see how it's useful. Basically what we might be trying to do at this school is to essentially increase our ability as a group to maintain ourselves somewhat reliably in World 24. In other words, to read its signals, to track by it, to apply the logic appropriate to imaginal causality to this sphere, and so to to read the signs of the times from the light of that, rather than from the light of the view of the much more pedantic and plotting logic of World 48. So we try to do that in a longer wisdom school, we do that longer. And that's not going to be the major focus on this gathering, just because we need 2 weeks to do it. But to be able to allow World 24, anchored in World 12, to infuse our lower realm, in which, you know, there's less and less 48, you know. But I really find that my particular work is to see if we can get 48 alive again. And, you know, if we can draw on the enormous assistance that's available to us in Worlds 12 and World 24 to help World 48 recover from a kind of catatonic terror and assert the strength and courage that comes in courtesy and civility in virtue, you know, in altruism, and to really kind of see if we can draw on what's there to kickstart that, so that civility returns and we have some sort of a wedge and a trickle-down effect against this rising tide of 96 and 192, which is engulfing not only our country but our planet. So anyway, if you find that shorthand useful, that's what we'll be using. We're going to take a break for about a half an hour at this point, and go and just walk around a little bit, breathe some air, get some coffee if you need it, because we'll come back. And I'm going to rocket through a little bit faster than I'd like the ray of creation and take this map of the worlds and then transpose it onto the map that's of the planets, the solar systems, and their names. We've done this before, so hopefully it will be review for most of you. And I'll give private coaching if I go through it too fast. But that being done, once you get back, we'll have a very intense, at least three-quarters of an hour before lunch, but then you get some time off for good behavior. So get whatever fortification you need. I'll probably be hanging out pretty closely here if anybody needs to, if wants to buy books or anything like that. Okay, so disperse.
Yes, disperse.
Yeah.
So there was a bit of a...
What did you find?
I'm going to go back to...
Oh, my goodness.
See if I can find her.
Okay. Wow,
if
right.
It was a block.
I'm just going to walk.
When the primer is going together, they...
Oh, no.
They reverse it.
Oh, dear.
It may not be an all copies, but that's very unusual. Bob, that can happen, but you probably never...
Wow.
It doesn't go through, like, a big block of them.
Well, we all see how many of them actually are...
Did you get it out of this box?
Yeah.
This one's good?
Yeah. Let's separate them out then and find out.
You'll see it easily by
just flipping.
I'm Bob.
Yeah.
Do you want this? Do you want magnifier?
No.
You don't need
it.
Bob,
what page?
You'll see just
play
reading.
Okay.
Not
the best.
I have a question sometimes about the...
I actually want them to form copies.
Yes.
Yeah.